York, 2:30 p.m. in Johannesburg, and 7:30 p.m. in Bangkok. Welcome to the Expat Happy Hour. This is Sunday Schneider Bean from SundayBean.com, and I'm a solution-oriented coach and intercultural strategist for individuals and organizations. And I am on a mission to help you adapt and succeed when living abroad and get you through any life transition. Let's be honest. Who hasn't dreamed of being published in a mega reputable magazine? You know, the Washington Post, the New York Times, I don't know, Vogue, if you're into that. Who wouldn't love to get paid to read about and write about topics that interest you? I don't know about you, but I am so nerdy. I would love to do that. Who would love to be able to get paid no matter where you live? I know one woman who is living this dream, and I've invited her onto Expat Happy Hour to demystify some of the myths behind being a published writer and offer practical tips on how you can do that too. So Olga Mecking is here with us today. Olga, welcome to Expat Happy Hour.
Hello, happy to be here.
So Olga, she is amazing. She's a writer, a journalist, a translator. Originally from Poland, Olga lives with her German husband in the Netherlands. Sound familiar? A very international life. Olga's writing has been published in the BBC, The Guardian, The Atlantic, CNN, and I can't even count how many others. And, you know, Olga is so wonderful. We've known each other through various groups online for quite a while. And I know what I know about her is when she's not writing or thinking about writing, she is probably reading or drinking tea. So welcome so much to be here, Olga. We're so happy to have you.
As I said, I'm happy to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So one thing I want to share, and I've shared this with you already, Olga, but our listeners don't know this. When I met Olga, I was really surprised. So, you know, I've seen all the work that Olga's been doing online. I've watched your development over time. And we were in The Hague at the same time for the FIGT conference, the Families in Global Transition. And I was having lunch with a few other colleagues, and it was like, oh, wait a minute, you're Olga? And I'm like, I'm Sunday. And I was so surprised when I met you, Olga, because you were so tiny physically, and you're so packed with power. And I think that's what took me off guard when I first met you.
That's I do get that a lot, especially from people who have only met me online. And I'm maybe, well, 1.60 meters. I don't know how much, or 58, how much that is in feet and inches. I think it's like 5'2" or something, I think.
Yeah.
And because I checked. And people tell me, oh, yeah, I thought you'd be bigger. Like, well.
I start to take this personally, because when people meet me, they go, oh, you're taller than I am. Big presence. I don't know what that says about me. But one thing I want to share about Olga that really illustrates the bigness of her is, you know, in preparation for our discussion today, I was looking through some of her work. And I was browsing through things like something you wrote for Teen Vogue. And then I came across your NPR feature, The Assault, on video campaigns that aim to unify Poland to the power of bread. I was reading through it. And it's this article that Olga wrote that highlights people from five marginalized groups. The LGBT community, Muslims, refugees, people of color, Jews, all of them coming together, baking and selling bread to customers in this bakery in Warsaw. And I read your article, watched the video that it was centered around, and I noticed I went from, you know, Teen Vogue to literally wiping tears from my eyes. I was trying to hold back my emotions because I had a live training I was about to deliver and record. And that experience, I'm sharing that because it's an illustration of, you know, tiny package packed with power.
Thank you so much. So basically this article, it's one of those situations when everything comes together. You have the good, you know, the good idea, you have the right sources who will give you amazing quotes. you have an editor who accepts your idea and helps you make it better. And because when I first wrote the story for NPR, the editor said, no, actually, we cannot publish that. It's not good enough. And I thought, oh, okay, what do I do now? I've written it. I interviewed all those people. I've done all this work. And now they're not going to publish it. So I went back to the editor and I said, you know what? If you're open to it, I will just rewrite it and make it better and then send it back to you. And I did just that. And then she came back to me with some further edits, but it ended up being published. So, you know, if you see an article published on NPR or the New York Times or the Atlantic or anything really, I think people don't realize that there's a whole other story going on behind the scenes. Like how many right. edits did the story get, or, you know, maybe it wouldn't have been accepted at this publication. So that's the part of writing that's actually pretty unnoticed, I think.
Oh, you know, I think you hit something right on the head, that this idea of, you know, overnight success takes 15 to 20 years. That there's, you know, people watch, like, oh, wow, you got something, you know, published in the Washington Post. But what they don't see, and I think this is something you said to me when we were together, what they don't see are, you know, the 20 rejection letters you got before the thing got published.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit, Olga. How did you get here? I know that you grew up as a third culture kid. How did you get to being such a prolific writer?
So so I think I started out as a blogger. So I had a blog, which I started in 2011, when my second daughter was just born. She was maybe 6 weeks old when I started blogging. And I set it up as a way to share stories and my experiences of being a mother abroad. And basically, I wanted a place where I could write about anything really that came to my mind. And also, you know, if you just had a baby, I don't know about you, but I felt really stupid. And if there's one thing I do not like, it's being stupid. So I kind of felt, okay, I have this baby and I'm feeling stupid. So I use blogging as a way to exercise my brain.
I think that what happens when you're not doing anything active, that you start to believe that you're not capable of more.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, there are women who kind of have, you know, they have the babies and they feel this is enough and that's great. It just never was that way for me, because when I had my eldest, I was writing my MA thesis for university, and it was very hard because it's quite difficult to concentrate when you have, you know, a 1, 2, 3 months old baby who always needs something at every second of your day. But it was very good. I felt very, yeah, it made me feel capable of something. And it was a great feeling how writing can, you know, it can be therapy. It can be just the feeling of being a, you know, a thinking human being, and not just, you know, because a lot of early parenting is about your body, you know, feeding and caring and you know, hugging and changing diapers. It's very physical. And I like writing because it was so abstract and so it was brain work, right? And that gave me a good balance between the parenting thing and the writing.
Right, so it was almost like a brain survival strategy.
Yeah, it was. I think it was a good description, what you just said. Very, very right, yeah.
Okay, so Olga, you started this writing thing as a way to just basically distract yourself from you know, that hard time as being a parent. Did you have any dreams of becoming this, you know, high profile writer? What were you thinking at that time?
When I started blogging, I was just thinking about, you know, will I publish the next blog post and when and how often? And I was just trying to get through the day and trying to publish something, at least at the beginning.
So when did it start to be like, you know what, I can actually get published in really big places? When did you start aiming higher than just your own blog?
Yeah, so I guess that it's a good question. It's hard to kind of, because see it as a continuous thing rather than first this happened, then this happened. So I got into many Facebook groups for writers and bloggers. One of them was Multicultural Kid Blogs. And I found that my blog posts and my ideas resonated with people. And mm-hmm. published on other people's blogs, and then they publish things on my blog. And I started getting requests, can we repost your, like republish your blog post on our site? Can we get posts for you? Can we do this? Can we do that? And I said, oh, okay, that's getting interesting. I'm getting responses from people, and people are, you know, interested in what I have to say.
Yep. So for those who are listening, what I'm hearing, a very simple piece of advice is to get your work out there and then see what resonates, right? So that's what you did. You tested it and then you saw what resonates. So you've been down this road. Tell us a little bit about what advice do you have to anyone listening who says, God, I would love to get published while I'm living abroad because, you know, I'm looking for something independent. I see so many interesting things. What advice do you have for them on how to get started?
So as I mentioned, I guess it would depend on in what stage of writing are you, right? Because
yep.
when I started blogging, I would never have, there was just no chance for me to be published in The Atlantic or Washington Post or any of those big places. And so English is actually my third language. So I speak Polish from birth and German. I learned German when I was three and English when I was maybe 10 or so. And so for me, it maybe would take longer to get what I am at now than, for example, for someone who is a native English speaker and maybe has some experience writing.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I just love how you just casually say that, like English is your third language and you're getting published in The Atlantic. It is incredible. That's what I mean about tiny package, big power.
No, but
it's incredible. And how did you overcome any self-doubt that you might have had that your English was good enough to get published?
Yeah. So first of all, I practiced. So when I got to a point where I could blog more regularly, well, because my kids got older and they went to school, and so I had more free time. And I found that, well, I practice a lot, and I think I was publishing 3 times a week.
Wow, that's incredible. 3 times a week?
Yes. Yeah,
so wow, how many hours? How many hours were you investing a week?
No idea. Because, well, so about blogging, at that time it was easier, I think, because, well, the only thing I had to do was to write the post and just publish it. And now it would have taken longer because I would have needed SEO and I would have needed, 3,000 pictures and in all in different formats, because you need a picture from Pinterest and one from Facebook and just mm-hmm. thing that would have taken me maybe, you know, half an hour of my time mm-hmm. to up to an hour. It was suddenly taking longer. And that was one of the things I actually moved to writing for others, because I didn't have to care about, like, I didn't have to worry about SEO and or about pictures. It was the editor's job to do that for me. So that was very nice.
Right. So you were able to just focus on the writing and let them do the marketing side.
Yeah, well, of course, I do have to market as well. I have to share the stories I've published on my Facebook page and the newsletter and Twitter. But like the teeny tiny stuff that you have to do while blogging or writing and, you know, online, I didn't have to worry about that. So I only had to worry about finding good ideas, finding sources, finding the publication to pitch it to, and just writing the story right and, you know, in the best way I could.
Okay, so let's stop back there. Someone says, I'd love to be a writer, but I don't have any good ideas. What would you say to them?
Well, to be honest, I've never had this problem.
Because obviously not.
Because basically, it may be funny, but I walk through this world with a constant state of confusion. Why and how and who and why, you know, it's just, I'm asking myself so many questions, and writing is a great way to get those answered.
So that's so great. So if you want to be a successful writer, walk through the world in a constant state of confusion, asking why, how, and who. That's gold right there, Olga.
I'm sorry, just maybe sound a little stupid, but I think you have to be very curious. And you have to ask yourself a lot of questions. And maybe it's a big thing for us expat writers because we live abroad. And we actually always very puzzled about some things that happen in, you know, the countries we live in. And then we wonder, why do people behave in this way? Mm-hmm. Why do they do this and not that? And why, you know, why did this happen to them? And why did they react the way, why did I react the way I did?
And that's just fertile ground, isn't it? So anybody who's out there considering being a writer from abroad, all you have to do is get curious and share your puzzlement about why people do that. And I think what's the danger, at least from the people that I know, is they don't think it's going to be interesting for another audience.
Yeah, that's true. You have to know how to find stories that may be interesting for a different audience, or how to make those stories interesting.
So find a story from where you're at that would be interesting for an audience somewhere else, or I'm just trying to get this into my brain, or find a way to make a story that's local interesting to others. Can you give us an example of one of those stories that you've done?
Yeah, of course. So for New York Magazine, I wrote a story about this sociological term called the spiral of silence. And it's the idea that when people feel they're a part of a minority, they wouldn't speak up about some certain issues. And it was 2016 and Trump was just elected. And took this, you know, story, this idea no one knew about, and I did because I studied German, and you know, it's a German kind of term idea, analyzing why Hitler came to power in Germany. And I kind of took that idea and said, oh, look, it's kind of a similar thing happening now with Trump, and adapted it to an American audience.
Right. Wow. So that you're just so whip smart though, Olga. But that's a great idea. So if people are listening and want to have ideas, look at what's going on in your local context. How could it translate to another one? And I really feel like that, you know, I've watched you give presentations on how to get published abroad. And that's one of the strengths I notice is how you can take something and put it in an unusual context, or challenge why do we do it that way, or compare how people do it differently somewhere else. So there's, I believe, you know, from what I've learned from you and what I've seen in my own time abroad, is that if you want to be a published writer, being an expat or living internationally is such a fertile ground for ideas.
Yeah.
So if you are going to, we talked about, you know, getting the right ideas, you've given us a couple tips there, either, you know, cross cultures, what does that look like if I cross this into another context, or asking powerful questions like why, how, or who, when you're in your local context to make it interesting for others. You also talked about where to get it published. What should we know? If someone has a great idea, they'd love to share it, but they don't know what is the next step. What should they do next?
So what they should find the right publication for the story. And then you can think, okay, what kind of story is this? Is it a food story? Is it a parenting story? Is it a business story? And of course, for each of those topics, there are magazines, publications, there are places to publish this.
So you have to be really well read, I think, if you want to get published in multiple places. You really need to be well rounded or read very broadly. Tell me where I'm wrong.
Yeah, it's. I do believe so. You have to look at magazine because you probably already read like the New York Times, and you probably read all those other Time magazine. You know, all those other places that people want to be published in, but you do. You may not think of it as a place that would publish you.
And
you may see it as a place for recipes, or a place for your news, your daily news, or get information about what's happening in the world. And you're looking at it as a source of information, but not as a place that will publish you.
Right. So that what I'm hearing is you need to have a mindset shift. Instead of looking at these magazines as something you can consume, you instead see it as how can I contribute to the conversations that these publications create.
Yeah, that's precisely it.
Okay, that's exciting. So I love that. That's a mindset shift. I mean, to be honest, I'm really transparent here. I love to write. I did a lot more blogging before I started my podcast. I've thought about there's some really big publications I'd like to get published in, but they feel really unattainable. What does it take? Let's say I've got a good idea. Let's say I'm a decent writer. Then what next? How do I get into that big, fancy publication?
Well, you find the right editor.
And how do you do that?
That's a good question. I didn't actually know it, and I didn't know how to do it. I wouldn't even consider doing it. But I got into some other groups of writers on Facebook, and they were like, I was just published in this place. And they, you know, one thing you can do is to network with other writers and ask them for editors' contacts.
Mm-hmm. That's a great tip. Network with other writers, right?
Or you can actually, you know, many magazines have this thing called a masthead, or our team, or about us.
Yeah.
We can find, if sometimes there's just one person you pitch, and sometimes there are, you know, section editors. And then, of course, if it's a food story, then you pitch the food editor. Well, it can get more complicated because some stories, like the NPR story I wrote, it was a food story, but it was also a social justice story.
Right.
So it could have gone both ways in this case.
Right. And that's where your creativity really, I think, is your strength here, is by being able to see what angle that you could pitch the story. So let's say I've got the great idea. I'm confident in my writing. I've identified a publication I want to get published in. I've even found the editor's contact details. What's next?
Well, you basically send them an email saying, you know, who are you? Why are we writing? And what's your idea? And where have you been published before, or if at all? And that's called a query letter or a pitch. And
yep.
And I don't know about you, but when I first started pitching, I looked at, you know, the New York Times and the Atlantic and thought, what business do I have at contacting them and writing to them and having them look at my emails and taking their time. But you know, it is my job as a writer to pitch magazines. And it's their job as editors to assign stories. So it's actually very much my business to do just that.
Oh, you're giving me chills right now, Olga. That is that, you know, because there's such a parallel to coaching there of whose business are you in. What you've done so beautifully is you stayed in your business. My job is to write and to pitch. Their job is to decide how they spend their time and attention, right? So you stay in your corner, they stay in theirs. So that's an excellent strategy for anybody who's listening, because what's so easy is to get caught up in, oh, they won't like my idea. They don't think I'm, you know, a good enough writer yet, or maybe I haven't written enough bylines, et cetera, et cetera. It's so easy to get caught up in that. And you just stayed in your own business. This is one of the reasons why I'm sure you're so successful, Olga. So tell me, I'm really curious. So we've got the pitch. You said in the pitch who you are, why you're writing, what's the idea, and I'm guessing where you've been published and why it's perfect for their publication.
Exactly.
So I'm what advice do you have for people who aren't yet published elsewhere. What would you suggest they say in that first pitch?
So I think I always come back to blogging, but I think it's not just a great place to publish your stories, but it's also a great portfolio, right? If you haven't published anywhere yet, anywhere else yet, then your blog, you can say, well, I have this blog, and you can see what I've written, and maybe give them 3 blog posts that you've written. Or maybe if you have guest posted for bigger blogs, bigger websites, you can do that.
Yep. That's great. So either start your own blog, because I think it goes back to, if you want to write, then write, because you're going to get better at it. You're going to find your voice. You're going to, you know, gain, like you said, a portfolio. So there's nothing against starting to write on your own blog. So that's excellent. What do you think, you know, so you're living this life where you're getting paid to write, you're getting recognition and credibility. What do you think are some misconceptions that people have about being a writer like you are?
Okay. So one thing that I had was that I can't write for American and British publications because I'm not a native speaker of English. And also because I don't live in the UK or the US. And I was kind of surprised to suddenly find out that that wasn't true, that it was in fact, that I could do it actually, to write for American British publications. And sometimes they would say, oh, actually, your background is so interesting. And of course, if I write about Poland, and I'm actually Polish, and I think editors love that because they have someone with credibility who knows the language, knows the culture, and can translate that for another audience altogether.
Right. So there's a tip right there for those who are listening. Use your native language and native culture to your advantage when you're pitching to a totally different audience, whether it's around an understanding a concept in a way that people from that other context don't, or whether you have a perspective that's unique outside of the cultural context. So you can actually leverage your interesting background to be published in other places, because being Polish feels normal in Poland, right? But it's exotic in the US.
Yeah, pretty much. And well, of course I would say that there is like, so for example, you know, if a native speaker makes a typo in an email, it's, you know, okay. But if I make a typo in an email, then maybe the editor might think that my English isn't good enough. Mm-hmm. I have to pay more attention to those things and pay more attention to kind of say things like, well, this idea relates to an American audience because I have to make my case more clear than someone else, for example.
Right.
But okay. I definitely, you know, try to use that to my advantage.
Yeah, that's great. So this is one thing I learned, Olga, living in Switzerland for 10 years. There was a long time I spent trying to be as Swiss as the Swiss, right? I was trying to, I'm probably Swisser than the Swiss now, but I'm trying to get the job like they had, or, you know, have the qualifications like they did. And then there was one point where I just stopped and I said, listen, what if you used your differences as an advantage?
Yeah.
And once I started thinking like that, things really shifted for me. And I think that's for anybody who's listening, who's living outside of their cultural context or is crossing cultures regularly. I really believe as an interculturalist that using our differences to add value will bring you so much further than minimizing your differences and trying to do it just like them.
Exactly. Well, for me, the problem, of course, was that I couldn't find if I wanted to find a Dutch job, let's say, I would have to compete with Dutch people. And if I wanted to find an English-speaking job, I would have to compete with the, you know, Americans, British, and so on. So I kind of tried to, instead of doing that, I tried to do something different. And I do believe in using what you know, especially, for example, in writing. So I know Polish, German, some, you know, Dutch, and some French. And I can write about it in English. And I've lived in several countries. I've had several jobs. And each of those experiences gives me just one more thing to write about.
Okay, that is perfect what you just said here. So I'm going to make sure the audience has got that. If you're thinking about becoming a writer or writing more for publications, do what Olga's done. Olga has taken stock of the languages she either speaks or has been exposed to. So that's a conceptual framework that is interesting. You can draw on the locations you know, especially those who are rotational expats. Maybe you've been to the Congo, and that's super interesting if you write an article about what's going on in the Congo, even if you live in Japan, right? So what countries have you lived in that you can offer a unique perspective? And the last thing you said is, what jobs have you done? Whether they are totally banal jobs at one time when you scraped paint off the windows at this apartment complex, to an exciting job as a travel guide, right? Any sort of normal average job or those exotic jobs are interesting perspectives to share in writing.
Yeah, of course. And it's, you know, it's, and for example, let's say you worked as a programmer and you can kind of still write about programming, or if you, you know, worked as a lawyer, you can write about the law and each of those topics, you know, the law and computer science and healthcare and any of those, and parenting, any of those could be looked at from several different perspectives. And, you know, the angles will be different. And also the let's call it packaging would be different. So you can write essays, you can write reported stories, you can write opinion pieces, you can write features, you can write profiles, you can write anything. Oh, of course, maybe
it's
not
limitless.
It is. And then, of course, you can kind of take two ideas and from different topics of different, you know, areas and bump them together and see what happens then.
Well, what I love about that is I'm thinking about, you know, a typical accompanying spouse who gives up their profession as a lawyer, as a pharmacist, as a who knows what, water specialist, and they move abroad and they have small kids and they focus more on their family than their career. And then, you know, 4, 5, 6 years down the road, they're asking, now what? And it's so easy to forget that your profession that you were doing a few years back is still a useful perspective. So I'm loving this example that you're giving, because I think for accompanying partners who haven't practiced their profession in a while, but might be interested in still being active professionally, could keep in the industry by writing about it and sharing their perspective. So excellent advice right there, Olga. Thank you for sharing that. Listen, you are an idea machine, Olga, and that's, I know, one of the reasons why you're successful. And I know that you help others be successful in their writing. Can you tell us a little bit about how you support people who are aspiring to be writers?
So I've just started offering, I don't know, I wouldn't call it coaching, really. So if, let's say, someone has an idea and doesn't know what to do with it, and, you know, doesn't have the editor's contacts, or doesn't know how to write a pitch, or doesn't know how to write an essay, then I would be happy to look at it and give some advice.
It sounds like you're consulting other writers to get published. Oh my gosh, I could imagine. And just for those who are listening, I went to a talk with Olga in The Hague, and I took copious notes during your talk. I think you only talked for maybe 20 minutes. And I walked out of there feeling like I had a roadmap. Okay, now that I've listened to what you had to share, I feel much more confident about what I need to do and what are the next steps. So that was just from 20 minutes with you. I can't imagine what kind of value you add for when you work side by side with someone. So if you're interested in being an aspiring writer, you want to get direct advice from someone who is living it, Olga is your person. I will make sure that I put your contact details in the blog and the show notes. Olga, where can people find you?
So I have a website. I've kind of deleted my blog, so it's no longer live, but I have a website now. It's www.olgamaking.com. And of course, I have a Facebook page, I have a newsletter. You can reach me by email, which is olga.making@gmail.com. Otherwise, Facebook, Twitter, I do that too. So,
and you know what? If someone's listening and they're like, oh, I don't know how to spell it. What do I do? Or you don't have the blog in front of you, just email me at sunday@sundaymean.com and I will connect you with Olga.
Oh, it's so nice.
Yes. Olga, you are such a pleasure. One thing I want to say before we say goodbye, well, I'm going to say it to the audience and not to you because it's going to maybe make you embarrassed, but Olga is so understated. I just want everybody who's listening to know, Olga, you are so impressive in the amount of writing you do, the consistency, the quality, and the outcomes. You are, everything you've said today, you say as if it's, you know, no big deal, but you are truly impressive. And I know that you've worked hard to get here. I know that you just have these great strategies about pushing through, pitching consistently and moving forward, even if something doesn't get accepted. So I just wanted to brag on you a little bit. I think that you're understated in your accomplishments. And I wanted to make sure that anybody listening knows that they're dealing with an absolute powerhouse. So thanks so much, Olga, for sharing your wisdom today.
No, I just want to say, because it sounds like, you know, I woke up like that, you know, published in The Atlantic. And that's I think, another misconception, right? This mm-hmm. idea of, as you said, overnight success. There's a Korean writer I know, and she was also told, oh, you're just suddenly everywhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'm not suddenly everywhere. I started doing it a while ago already, and I've been doing it for years before it happened.
Yeah, exactly. So anybody who's listening, know that if you feel like you're not making as much progress as you see happening with other writers, know that there's another story behind. I know from my own business, this is the fifth year of my business, that it's like, you know, you can't reap at the same time you sow. I think that's a Pinterest quote. I'm sure it's from someone really famous. But that you really, there's an impatience that you have. But if you do the work, if you're consistent, that you'll see results over time. So thank you, Olga, for sharing your knowledge. And thank you, everyone who's listening. You are listening to Expat Happy Hour with Sunday Bean. I'll leave you with the words of Marva Collins, one of the most influential African-American teachers and education activists of the 20th century. Success doesn't come to you. You go get it.